Hi, I'm Sam Cedar.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, Justin Schweitzer, policy analyst at the Poverty to Prosperity Program for the Center for American Progress, joins me to discuss the reasons why we should eliminate the tipped minimum wage in favor of the regular raised minimum wage.
And Heather Digby Parton will help me run down the biggest stories of the week. Hey, more than ever, a reason for you to become a member starting this week, and you can do so over at ROFpodcast.com. Today, behind the paywall, as a bonus, I will be talking to Harvard Constitutional Law Professor Lawrence Lessig about H.R. 1. It is what he calls an incredibly important piece of legislation to save not just voting rights and anti-corruption policies, but literally to save our democracy. Lawrence Lessig, a very, very smart individual. Check him out by becoming a member today. Go to ROFpodcast.com. It is your support that keeps this show going, and going forward, we will have bonus interviews for you. Also, here to break down this week's news, Heather Digby Parton from Salon and the popular blog Hullabaloo. So, Heather, I am ostensibly on vacation this week, but I wanted to check in and review what has been going on this week. Of course, there was some major, major scandals that broke, and frankly, couldn't have happened to two nicer guys, as far as I'm concerned. We have, of course, Andrew Cuomo with a sort of rolling series of scandals that he is dealing with as governor of New York. And the latest, of course, is new reports that while he was locking up a $4 million advance on his book about leadership, he was also having staffers cover up the fact that there were more deaths at nursing homes than had been revealed by New York state government. And frankly, there was a whole host of reasons why there was so many, but many of them had to do with his own decision-making. And then, of course, we have Matt Gaetz, who, boy, it is even more salacious, I think. And we'll get to that in a moment. But let's just start with Cuomo, because this has been pretty extraordinary, the way this guy has I don't want to say fallen apart. I mean, there are many of us in New York who have had a problem with him for an extended period of time. But it seems to me it's a story of a bully showing a little bit of weakness and then everybody deciding now's the time.
Absolutely. I mean, look, it's hubris for one thing. I mean, the guy sort of apparently, because of all the adulation that he got during the first months of the COVID pandemic, somehow or another just kind of decided that, you know, he was infallible. And apparently he's been a bully this whole time, which doesn't surprise me. I mean, it just seems like his personality, it seemed obvious to me that this guy was kind of a jerk, right? I mean, I can't say that any of these revelations about the way that he treats people and the way that his staff sort of operates around him, kind of like a bunch of, you know, sort of vicious henchmen and henchwomen. It doesn't surprise me, just judging from his personality, that you can actually see. And you're exactly describing the dynamic as I see it, which is that this guy has treated everybody like dirt, and people around him and his henchmen and women have been horrible and have been absent. They're beyond bullies. It's more like they've acted like mob bosses. And so once that, you know, the bleeding starts, when somebody gets, you know, gets weakened, which he is, then they have no friends, and all they have is enemies, and people are glad to see him go down. And, I mean, he was coming to the end of his run anyway. I know he was going to run again, but he's not going to run again. I mean, I mean, he can try, but I don't think he can win again, and may not make it to the end of his term anyway. I mean, a lot of people have already called for his resignation. And you know, he's destroyed by his own arrogance and his own bad behavior, which meant that, you know, when the way he acted, regardless of, you know, I mean, the sexual harassment stuff is horrible too. And it seems obvious that this guy felt like he could just say and do anything. I mean, he doesn't appear to be Harvey Weinstein level harasser, but so what? He's an abuser across the board of his authority with everyone, including with the women that he is alleged to have harassed. So, you know, this is one of those situations where, boy, it just sure looks like it's what goes around comes around. I mean, somebody does, you know, you act like this, and at some point or another, it's going to catch up to you. And when it does, you're not going to have anybody to defend you when that happens.
I also want to make it clear, though, that the problems with Cuomo go far beyond his personal demeanor. I mean, I think his personal demeanor is, but I think, you know, people need to be reminded of this. There was something called the Moreland Commission, which was a commission set up ostensibly to look at corruption in Albany, which is the capital of New York, for those of you who do not know. And Albany and really New York state politics has been considered just incredibly corrupt for an extended period of time. And the Moreland Commission started to look into the governor himself a little bit, and then he immediately disbanded it. And then from a pure policy standpoint, this is a guy who oversaw things like the closure of 10-20% of New York's public hospitals, which obviously became very problematic during COVID. This is a guy who cut Medicaid during the first months of the COVID outbreak of the pandemic. This is the thing that I think, like, this is the thing that's very frustrating, I think, for New York progressive Democrats and progressives largely. I mean, I can tell you this, that I sat in a room, this was before Zephyr Teachout got 35% of the vote in a Democratic primary, and that was, you know, close to 8 years ago. This is, I think, in his second term, I think, or... it must have been. I sat in a room with about 20 or 30 leaders of community-based organizations who specifically work on helping the poor, people living in poverty, people who are unhoused, people of color, communities that are under stress. And it was, I was amazed, because when they were talking about the idea of primarying Andrew Cuomo, many of them said, you know, there's a good argument we'd be better off with a Republican. I mean, he has had, he was pushing charter schools after his, one of his patrons, Ken Langone, required him to. And perhaps the biggest sort of policy thing that he was involved in, that should make him really, frankly, just loathed by Democrats, is that he midwifed and nurtured a renegade caucus in the Democratic Party known as the IDC, the Independent Democratic Caucus, who would caucus with Republicans in the New York State Senate, basically preventing any progressive legislation from passing both houses within New York State, because Andrew Cuomo did not want to have to veto legislation that was coming from Democrats, because he wanted to keep his options open, I guess, to run for president. And so for 4 years under Cuomo, Democrats got nothing done. And it all changed when Cynthia Nixon ran against him and really spent a lot of that campaign exposing the IDC. And so, and we just recently, this past week, we now have recreational use of marijuana in this state. We have seen many progressive changes as a function of that primary. So Andrew Cuomo is not only a bad guy as an individual, and not only, I think, corrupt, at least in the to the extent that, you know, he had his buddy, and I mean buddy, his friend, who is working, who's living at the governor's mansion, but working for free as the vaccination czar in New York, call up different counties, say, hey, I'm not calling about in my capacity as the vaccine czar. We will, you know, get you your vaccines. Just want to check on your loyalty to Andrew Cuomo now that people are attacking him. And, you know, this type of, this is just corruption as far as I'm concerned. And so he's that guy and more. And I wanted to, you know, make sure that people understood the context here. This is not just about, and it's, you know, that would be enough if he was just this type of executive. But it's about that and more with Andrew Cuomo. And so let's turn, and it remains to be seen. I think he's going to just hang in there. I don't think he's a guy who has any shame. I think he,
Looks like it.
Think he, you know, we've seen now Gillibrand and Schumer and most of the congressional caucus, or New York caucus. We've seen the speaker of the New York State Legislature, the House, call for his resignation, not doing it. So, it remains to be seen. And, you know, to some extent, progressives, Democrats are using this, his weakness, as leverage in negotiations with him. I mean, you know, what comes around goes around indeed. So this is what's happening with Andrew Cuomo. But let's talk about Matt Gaetz. Now, Heather, I've been reading about it. I've been on vacation. So I'm going to let you explain to me what the heck is going on with Matt Gaetz.
Someone found out that he was in trouble. Rumors were flying that Gaetz had a problem, and specifically he had a problem with this guy down in Florida who was a friend of his who has been indicted by the federal government for a number of crimes, which I'll get to. But this, it turned out that Gaetz was associated with this guy, as is Roger Stone, by the way. And so someone found out about it, and the people who found out about it are involved with this family of a guy named, I think it's Levinson, who was an ex-CIA agent that was caught up in Iran someplace, disappeared in Iran years ago, in 2007. And they had, you know, been agitating for the government to get him back and do all this. And they'd been, you know, this is a family that's worked very hard to try and deal with this. And they have actually employed lawyers down there in Florida who've been involved in it. And were also friends, apparently, of this guy, Levinson. So recently, the government declared, we think he's dead. And they withdrew a $25 million reward that they had for him because they were declaring him dead and said, look, it's done, you know, it's time to move on. The family is unhappy with that. So these friends of Levinson, one of whom is a lawyer down in Florida, and some other people that have been on this case, you know, some sort of fringy type characters, apparently approached Matt Gaetz' father, who's very wealthy and a big wheel in GOP politics down there, and said, hey, we hear your kid's in trouble. And we think that if you put up some money to get this guy Levinson, you know, to do a reward, get that reward thing going again, if we can get him out, it's going to make Matt look really good. And then, you know, they won't be able to go after him for these crimes that he's, you know, suspected of being involved with. It's ridiculous, of course. And, you know, in fact, I read in one place, and I've only read it once or twice, that they even suggested that Joe Biden would pardon Matt Gaetz, which is completely ridiculous. But apparently the dad, who wasn't born yesterday, said, this is weird. I feel like I'm being extorted. He went to the FBI. The FBI wired him up. Apparently he met with some of these people. We don't know yet what that really is, whether it was an extortion plot or whether it really was something that these friends of the Levinson family were trying to do. Matt Gaetz is saying that that is trying to make everybody think that's the story here. It's not the story. There's a real scandal. And maybe that happened. I mean, we don't even know. It's not impossible for someone to be guilty of crime and also be a victim of a crime at the same time. And maybe they were trying to extort him. It doesn't. That's not the point. Matt Gaetz himself has been involved with this guy in Florida. And his name is Greenberg, and he was elected as a tax collector, I think it's Seminole County, whatever. And he is friends with Roger Stone. He's involved with the Proud Boys. There's all kinds of weird connections with Trump world in here, including Matt Gaetz, who is pictured with this guy at the White House, and there's pictures that, you know, of him on the guy's Instagram page. We don't know yet how deep their friendship is, but according to reporters, local reporters down there, they partied a lot together, this guy and Matt Gaetz. And that means something, because this guy is way beyond. I mean, the things he is accused of doing, he won the tax collector job, immediately went in and fired a bunch of people, and then spent all this money, this taxpayer money, on buying a bunch of guns and computers for a side gig he had, and then he was stealing identities that he was getting as the tax collector. He stopped some woman on the highway because they give him a little badge, because the tax collectors have a little badge. Everybody was wearing guns, and he stopped some woman and said tried to pull her over for speeding, and he's just the tax collector. And, I mean, it gets really, really weird. But the upshot is that what they are accusing him of, aside from all those other things, is that he was involved with sex trafficking underage girls. And what that means in the federal context is that he was, you know, paying or exchanging, you know, goods and services and favors and you know, transporting underage girls across state lines, which, of course, is a federal crime. And apparently, the way this came up was when they went to his office to arrest him for these other crimes that I mentioned, that when they looked in his computers, they could see that he had been doing, you know, using this identity theft to create new identities and new IDs for underage girls and new IDs for himself. And so suddenly that sort of turned them into the, oh, my God, he's got something going on here. And that appears to be, and we don't know for sure, that somehow Matt Gaetz was involved in that. And they specifically reported that he was involved with one 17-year-old girl. We don't know, you know, specifically what happened. Obviously, he says he's not a target. He's a subject and, you know, whatever that means. But he's involved with this guy, and he seems to be involved with this guy on a level that is, you know, particularly untoward, considering that this guy is really beyond criminal. I mean, he's you know, he's nuts. I mean, there's something really wrong with him. So Gaetz, then, you know, so you've got the two stories going there. Gaetz goes on TV and tries to deflect onto this alleged extortion plot, and he goes on Tucker Carlson's show, brings up the seven, you know, in his first, you know, words out of his mouth, where I was not, you know, with a 17-year-old girl, which is not a good way to start talking about it. All the lawyers, you know, in the world are just kind of put their heads in their hands going, oh, my God, this guy's the worst
well, I think he
client
said,
in the world.
I think he said, I never traveled with a 17-year-old.
I never traveled with a 17-year-old girl. And, of course, that's not what he's accused of. He's accused of arranging travel for a 17-year-old girl across state lines. Or that's what we think he's accused of. I mean, I shouldn't be too sure about all the details here. But it does really looks like he's in big trouble.
Right. We should say there should be a lot more that he can say he did not do with a 17-year-old girl rather than right. travel with.
Exactly. That's just sort of, yeah, okay, well, that's nice. What else didn't you do with a 17-year-old girl? And he went on to say, you know, I've been very generous with my girlfriends, and I've always been very, you know, very kind of maybe paid for some hotel rooms, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that goes to this guy, you know, this guy Greenberg. He apparently was operating as a sugar daddy, they called it in the indictment, which just means that he's got these women, some are women and presumably some are underage, which makes it illegal, that, you know, he's kind of spending money, you know, keeping them. I guess that's the idea. And it sounds like maybe Matt Gaetz was kind of in that realm as well, because he kept going on about how I've been generous with my girlfriends. And he tried to rope Tucker Carlson into this by saying, you had dinner with me and a friend of mine who was questioned by the police. And Tucker Carlson just kind of sitting there going, oh, my God. And he goes, I don't remember anything about that. I don't know what you're talking about. And he was actually reportedly pretty angry that Gates brought him into it. And I think it's kind of funny that he did.
We should also say,
brought up the fact that Tucker Carlson has also been accused of, you know, a number. There was one several years ago, which he claims the woman was mentally ill. And then there was one recently with all the sexual harassment stuff that's been going on at Fox News. So he obviously did not like being brought into it. And I don't know that Gates was doing that purposefully, but I wouldn't be surprised, you know, to sort of, I think he may have thought that Tucker would go, yeah, it's a bitch, isn't it? But dude, you know how we always get accused of this stuff, but he didn't, you know, Carlson actually backed off. So, you know, now you've got the situation where it also turns out, and this is similar to the Cuomo thing. It's interesting that the two of them have it. Reports are that he is loathed inside the Republican caucus. People hate him. The only one who liked him was Donald Trump.
Right.
Everybody hates him, and they're all, you know, now there's all the backstabbing going on. It couldn't happen to a nicer guy, you know. Yeah, well, good to see him go out. Apparently, he's a real jerk to everybody, not surprisingly, and they couldn't stand him. So he's not going to have a lot of friends, although Kevin McCarthy, the House Minority Leader, did say that he wasn't going to kick him off any committees yet because he's going to wait and see what happens. But, you know, so here we are. I mean, this is a very convoluted scandal because you have these two separate things going on, both of which could be true, or either one could be true and the other one couldn't, or they could both be untrue, or at least untrue to the extent that Matt Gaetz didn't do anything wrong. I mean, it does appear, though, and the connections between Gaetz, this guy Greenberg, Roger Stone, the Proud Boys, there was a bunch of – one of the things that Greenberg is accused of doing was creating – fake Facebook pages for a rival of his in the election. And it was a fake Facebook page that was affiliated with Roger Stone and the Proud Boys. And of course, you know, Stone is a Florida guy too, right? And this is kind of his specialty. He's the dirty tricks master. You could definitely see him being involved, and they've all been pictured together and what have you. So, you know, at that point, you're looking at it and you go, look, this is just one degree of separation with Donald Trump, right? I mean, you're getting very close. Roger Stone is Donald Trump's political mentor, essentially. Trump pardoned him for his previous crimes. That's very, very close to the president here. And, of course, why wouldn't it be? I mean,
right,
we already know what his, you know, sexual – he's admitted it, you know, on tape,
right,
how he deals with these things. So there we are. And of course, it's got everybody very excited because Matt Gaetz is one of the biggest jerks in the Congress and has been an absolute, you know, thorn in the side of any decent human being, and apparently including even the Republicans. So watching somebody like him, you know, what goes around comes around is, you know, the Schadenfreude is really monumental with this one.
And we should say, though, you know, Republicans will be quick to jettison him. I think their only hesitation is, of course, Trump. But as of, you know, this conversation, my understanding is we've seen no Trump family members defend him publicly.
Nope.
And so that may be an indication of like, yeah, we're okay cutting them loose. And if that's the case, you know, he is from the Pensacola area, and our producer of this program is in that area as well. And I think he would be very quick to assure me that a Republican, sadly, is going to win.
Yeah.
Is going to own that seat regardless. So, I don't think that the Republicans would be worried about giving up that vote. What is interesting, though, is if anybody in the Trump clan jumps in and shows a certain amount of loyalty to this guy. They certainly don't seem to have any issue with what he's accused of necessarily, but it'll be curious if they show any loyalty to him, because if that's the case, things could create some political fissures within the Republican Party. And I'm looking at this just strictly as a political matter. But if not, it seems to me this will not have any sort of long-term implications for what the Democrats are trying to do, both in the House and the Senate, and frankly in the presidency as well. But it sure is fun to watch. Of course, we should keep in mind that there very well could have been some underage victims here that we should be mindful of. But in terms of Matt Gaetz, the guy has always struck me as somewhat problematic. And there's a lot of questions around this guy. So we will see what happens with that. But in terms of its political salience, it's unclear to me that it's going to have any, right? I mean, and so let's move into the other big news this week. Joe Biden announced his massive infrastructure bill. It's coming in two tranches. I'm not even quite clear if they're going to be passed at the same time or exactly what is going on with this. But there is a sort of physical infrastructure, for lack of a better term, component to the bill, and then a care economy element to the bill. So there's two tranches, if you will. He announced the first tranche, which, you know, I've seen a couple of different numbers, is around like $2 to $2.27 trillion. And there is, my understanding is, Heather, that, you know, the Larry Summers and the sort of deficit nags may have gotten a little bit to the Biden administration, and they pulled back on some of their numbers in some respects. $2 trillion, still pretty impressive, but, you know, we have a massive need for upgrading roads in this country and bridges and tunnels and broadband. And then they want to, promote the production of electric cars by putting up around the country electric charging stations. They want to address economic inequality by modernizing buildings such as VAs and hospitals. That, of course, would mobilize union trade workers, and it would provide for better schooling. There is, in this bill, $400 billion in care infrastructure, which would expand access to home or community care for people with aging relatives. There's $100 billion for workforce development for underserved communities. There is money in here for, you know, miners, people who work in mines, I guess. And this comes along with corporate tax raises from 21 to 28%. Which is still 7% lower than it was 3 years ago, right? It was at 35%. And the Biden administration would also propose, they can't enforce it, of course, but like a Paris Accord style agreement with other nations to basically say that there's a global minimum tax so that you can't evade these corporate taxes, et cetera, et cetera. So aside from the numbers being a bit lower than maybe people had come to anticipate in recent days, I think there is reason to be concerned about doing these things in two different tranches. The other one, we don't know the numbers, but we'll deal more with paid family leave, medical leave, expansion of childcare, both the permanence of the Affordable Care Act subsidies and the monthly child tax credit or allowance, if you want to call it. Those would be set to be in the second tranche, lowering the Medicare eligibility age to maybe 55 would be in the next tranche. So I get a little worried about, you know, the Biden administration saying we did one out of two is not bad. That's 500. You know, Ted Williams never bat 500. I'm using Ted Williams specifically because I think that's probably like contemporary baseball player for Joe Biden. That's where we're at. There's a lot of machinations happening. Pelosi wants to get this done by July 1st, at least on the House end, which people say sounds ambitious. It sounds like they're moving a little bit slow to me. But what's your take on this, Heather?
Well, I think I'm not sure it's Larry Summers who got to them, although he has been out there, you know, taking that position that where they're going to overheat the economy with all this money and they've got to, you know, pare it back. It's too much. Which figures, right? I mean, this not surprising, but I think maybe it's Joe Manchin that got to them, and he was, you know, starting to make noises about, you know, there being it being way, way too much, and it's never a good idea to negotiate with yourself, and certainly it's a shame that they have to negotiate with Democrats, but I'm guessing my assumption was that that's why the number had, I think they'd been talking about, you know, 3 to 4 trillion,
well,
and
hadn't
they came Manchin, in underneath that. So,
and
what you say about the tranches is concerning. I had assumed, and I could be totally wrong about this because I don't know the details of, I haven't really looked personally delved into the details of the way that what was in those two tranches. But my assumption was is that they were sort of, preparing for a reconciliation, the necessity of passing this through reconciliation. And as a result, they figured that they could definitely get the one tranche through reconciliation, but maybe not the other. Again, bringing us to the point where, we got to do something about the filibuster, because if you're talking about having to put everything through reconciliation, you end up, you know, cramping the agenda in very important ways. And I don't know that to be true. That had been what I thought. But, you know, as to the bigger picture here, it's a very ambitious program. It really is. It's exciting, and we shouldn't get too caught up, pessimistic about the size of it, because it's pretty big. And 2.7 trillion, even for a Democratic administration to propose such a thing, you know, is kind of astonishing. And it just shows that there has been a sea change in Democratic politics. I mean, and Joe Biden is not the guy I would have expected to do it, because, you know, he's just never been that kind of ambitious guy. But apparently that's where the zeitgeist is in his administration, and I think in the Democratic Party. But of course, you're also dealing with Manchin and, you know, whoever else. There's going to be some other ones too, believe me. It's not just going to be Manchin, because right, when you're talking about this kind of numbers and these kinds of big ambitious programs, you're going to have, I don't know, could be, you know, Chris Coons, it could be, you know, Hickenlooper.
It won't be Coons, but it could be.
There's going to be a handful of Democrats,
Warner,
who are going to have, yeah, a cow.
Well, you know, because didn't Manchin also say that he wanted a $4 trillion bill? I mean,
yeah, he did. And he also said, though, that he wanted, you know, major tax increases on corporations and the wealthy. He was willing to go along with that. You know, and, by the way, I saw something the other day, but from Stuart Stevens, you know, the never Trumper guy who used to work for all those Republicans.
Oh, I know him.
And he said, I was on Twitter. He said, you know, we always, you know, he said, I've made 100 ads talking about how awful it is to raise taxes, and we always knew that it was bunk, that it would never work. We did it sort of almost out of nostalgia, knowing that it never ever worked. He said that is not a winning argument for Republicans, which means that it is a winning argument for Democrats, right? I mean, I think it's
right,
either or. And you know, the polling always says, And it says, particularly this time, that you know, taxing people who make over $400,000 a year and taxing the hell out of corporations is popular. People think that makes sense. And, of course, it does. It's common sense. It's like, you know, come on, you've got enough money. You know, you can afford to kick in a little bit more. The country's falling apart, and especially for infrastructure, because I think everybody knows. I mean, setting aside Kristi Noem from South Dakota, who went on Fox yesterday and said, well, this doesn't sound like infrastructure to me. They're talking about pipes and housing, you know. What do you think infrastructure
wow.
is, lady? I mean, this is, you know, this is the level of understanding of what we're dealing with. So, and also the panic that you see on the part of the Republicans, you know, not just for the you know, the filibuster thing, but the way they came out swinging on this. They're going to fight it very hard, but they don't have the power to do anything, and I think they know it, unless they can leverage, you know, the centrists, the conservative Democrats into somehow squeezing it. But even if they squeeze it, Sam, it's still going to be a lot of money. I mean, may not be enough, but good Lord. I mean, I don't think they can win this. I mean, the Republicans just—they can't win it. They're dead in the water on this stuff. And if Biden can get this thing through, even, you know, if it isn't, you know, the numbers that we know are absolutely necessary, it's a pretty huge thing. I mean, it really is. And when you put that on top of the COVID relief bill, that's a lot of money coming out of the federal government for a change.
I mean, I think your call for perspective on this is valid. I can't help but think quicker is better, because the more that it hangs out there, the more people can sort of like chop it up. I'm very concerned about this second tranche, because that has some of the more structural sort of things in it, right? Like, increased subsidies to the Affordable Care Act, as much as I don't care for the Affordable Care Act, or at least the non-Medicaid, non-patient protection side of things. But increased money would go a long way to helping people. The
and if they can lower the Medicare eligibility
that's
huge. I mean,
but
that's
all second tranche stuff
to the healthcare system.
Yeah, this is all second tranche stuff, though. That's my concern. Is just that we're not gonna like, and that's gonna be the stuff that you throw over the extension on the child tax allowance. I mean, all of those things. But it is early in the process. Very important that people pressure their senators. Maybe you're stiffening their backbone, or maybe you're sort of like, you know, pushing them back into the fold, as it were. Joe Manchin wants to go out there, and he has figured out his formula, which is basically just make a stink and then just agree to vote for whatever. But there are others, like you say. I don't know if it's Chris Coons, because he's not going to buck Joe Biden, but maybe they've got a couple of like coordinated things in there. But, you know, there's going to be Mark Warners, there's going to be Hickenloopers, et cetera, Kristen Sinemas. And people have to pressure these politicians, pressure them to
absolutely
get it done
and
fast.
Can I just say, just so that people don't get the wrong idea, I am all for that pressure. And when I saw that AOC came out immediately and said, wait, this isn't enough. You know, what are you talking about? We got to get more. That's the job of the progressive left, is to do that, is to pressure that, to push that. I have no problem with it, because you never know. You know, it might actually work. Maybe they can get some of that money. You know, I mean, they've got a big caucus in the House. They have to be dealt with as well, you know, and this is how this works. So I am in no way suggesting that people should shut up and just accept whatever comes along. That's not that's not how this works. There's a negotiation, and it's not just with Joe Manchin. The progressives have, you know, they have power too. So, you know, go out there and do it. So I just wanted to make sure people understood my position there, that I'm not arguing for everybody to be quiet, because I don't think that's right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Heather, that's it for us today. We will be back next week to check out more.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Heather Parton is a weekly contributor, Ring of Fire. You can find her writings over at Salon.com and the popular blog Hullabaloo. Now, I turn the show over to my colleague, Emma Vigeland. Emma, take it away.
Hi, everybody. I am here with Justin Schweitzer, who is a policy analyst at the Poverty to Prosperity Program for the Center for American Progress. Thank you so much for joining me today, Justin.
Thanks for having me.
So you wrote extensively and did a lot of research on why the tipped minimum wage should be eliminated and replaced with a regular raised minimum wage. I found your case to be incredibly compelling, and I obviously agree with you. So I want to dive into some of those numbers that you lay out because they really just support the facts of the matter. So the Raise the Wage Act is being considered in Congress, and we had hoped that it would be included in the first COVID relief package, but Biden decided to, I'm not sure if it was the $15 minimum wage that included also these other aspects, but I digress. This Raise the Wage Act, it doesn't just raise the minimum wage, it phases out the sub-minimum wage for tipped workers, teenagers who are employed for a short period of time, and disabled workers. Can you break down how the Raise the Wage Act does this?
Absolutely. Yeah. So the Raise the Wage Act would, first of all, lift the minimum wage up to $15 an hour by about $1 a year. So it would be $15 an hour in 2025. The tipped minimum wage would reach equity with the regular minimum wage by 2027. So it would have to move up a little bit faster, about $2 a year, just because the tipped minimum wage is currently $2.13 an hour. So it has more room to catch up, but it wouldn't equal it in 2025 exactly. After 2025, the regular minimum wage would be indexed to the median wages, I believe it is. So it would keep increasing each year, but the tipped minimum wage would become equal with it in 2027. The issue with why it was taken out of the first COVID relief bill was actually because the Senate parliamentarian ruled that it couldn't be part of a budget reconciliation package, which is what they had to use in order to get pass it with 50 votes. So there was an attempt to get it put back in, but it would have needed 60 votes to get done. That's where we're at.
Yeah, but you could have overruled the parliamentarian and then avoided all of this. But, you know, Biden made it clear for reasons that are completely unclear to me that that was not going to happen. But yes, so the Raise the Wage Act, it would gradually increase, as you said, not just the standard minimum wage, which is mostly what's discussed in the media, but the tipped minimum wage, which is what your piece focused on. I want to zoom out a little to the history of the tipped minimum wage, because you laid that out so well, how there is a real racist history behind tip wages and how really they came to be in the modern United States as a way to underpay Black workers in the wake of slavery in the late 1800s. Can you start there?
Yeah, and other organizations like One Fair Wage and RSC United have really laid this out very well as well. I was kind of summarizing a lot of their work. But basically, in the aftermath of emancipation, Black workers still faced a lot of discrimination, but the hospitality industry kind of jumped at this opportunity to make them servers, and they would have to be servile to white patrons. And the actually tipping at the time was pretty frowned upon just in general, but the hospitality industry, like, it wasn't illegal. So the hospitality industry used this as a way to basically not pay any of the Black workers. There was no tipped minimum wage at the time, so they earned zero base wages. And then they just lived kind of at the mercy of the tips of their customers. And as you can imagine, the Black workers, who made up, I think it was 43% of the hospitality industry at the time, in the, I think, 1880-ish, faced a lot of abuse from their customers, from managers, from all kinds of people. It was a lot of Black women at the time. They worked 13, 14-hour days every single day for taking home very little. Then there's a big push to kind of get some sort of minimum wage in. In 1938, the Fair Labor Standards Act passed as part of the New Deal, but like a lot of the rest of the New Deal, it did not include a lot of occupations that had primarily Black workers. So there was no tipped minimum wage. There was no minimum wage for tipped workers, so they could kind of just still be excluded from the minimum wage. In 1966, there was an update to the Fair Labor Standards Act as part of the Great Society that actually set a tipped minimum wage at 50% of the regular minimum wage. So they got some base wage, but it still wasn't all the way, which was, again, another way to get the bill passed using with Southern senators still controlling much of the Senate.
It's almost like that history still remains today.
Yeah, absolutely. And so it was tied, it was 50% of the regular minimum wage. Eventually it was raised to 60% and then it went back down a bit. It was always tied to a percentage of the minimum wage until 1996, when Congress was raising the minimum wage up to, I think it was about $5 an hour, something around there. And they decided to sever the tipped minimum wage. And so the tipped minimum wage actually hasn't been raised since 1991, whereas the federal minimum wage has been raised a few times since then, but not since 2009.
Can you the federal minimum wage has been frozen at $7.25 an hour since 2009, but that severance seems to be so incredibly key, because it still would not be enough if it had remained pegged to the minimum wage. But can you talk about that decision? Because that seems bonkers to me that decision would be made, particularly under a Democratic president, although obviously Bill Clinton made some, decisions that affected poor people, with reverberations still being felt today.
Yeah, honestly, I don't know why they decided to sever it. It was just kind of something they chose to do. I'm sure there's some writing on that, but that's actually not something that I'm familiar with.
Well, it's fascinating either way. So that's just a massive moment, and then we're at this point where the disparity is even with the regular minimum wage being so so much lower than it should be, pegged to inflation, it should be at least $15. The tip minimum wage standards are even worse. And so then there's a power imbalance too that we can talk about as well. So tip minimum wage, or tipped wage workers in this country, they are often women, they are often people of color. And you wrote about how tipped wage workers, there's a power imbalance that is embedded in their work that makes them especially vulnerable and also in need of the kind of protections that a standard minimum wage would provide. Can you expand upon that?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you just put yourself in the shoes of, say, a woman working in food service, just a waitress at a restaurant, you're serving your customers, they're being extremely rude to you, but you only make $2.13 an hour before tips, you need a good tip from them. Even if they're being extremely rude to you, even if they're sexually harassing you, kind of your ability to pay rent, your ability to buy dinner that night is dependent on those customers. It's the same thing for people of color working in those jobs, experiencing racism. There's actually been a lot of reporting on the racism and sexual harassment that have been experienced just during COVID times. Masculine harassment is a new term that's being coined recently, where women are being asked to take their masks off for customers so that they can see their smile and see how much they should tip them based on that. It's disgusting. I think it's 78% of workers in general, of tipped workers right now, are reporting that they're getting less in tips, but it's actually 88% for Black workers. And then just generally, it's in my research in these tipped industries, 48% are people of color, whereas in the labor force as a whole, it's only 37%. Women, it's even more. It's 68% of women are in tipped jobs, whereas it's normally about 47% or so.
Yeah, those numbers are damning. And what's fascinating is that this already has been implemented quietly to some people in 8 states, California, Nevada, Minnesota, Washington, Alaska, I'm forgetting the other 3.
Oregon and Hawaii is technically they have a tipped minimum wage, but it's only if you make a certain amount of tips and it's about 75 cents below. So it's for all intents and purposes, they don't have a tipped minimum wage.
Okay. So can you talk about how those states implemented the tipped minimum wage and what that effect has had on those states in terms of jobs and their economy, and then also quality of life for the tipped workers.
Yeah. So I don't know the ins and outs of what happened in every specific state, but I know that they've all had one fair wage for many, many years now, well over a decade. And basically, they phased it in kind of the same way that the Raise the Wage Act would. They didn't just eliminate it and like double the wage all at once. It was kind of it was a slower phase in so that businesses would have time to adjust. And they have not been hurt by this at all. There are certainly, and I make this disclaimer in the report, there are certainly other factors that could contribute to why their tipped industries, their restaurants, their casinos, their barbershops, whatever, are doing just as well, or better in some cases, but certainly they are not suffering because of these tipped wages, because of the tipped minimum wage being eliminated. Some things that I looked at was the number of employees that work in these industries has actually grown by more in the one fair wage states, as I call them, than they do in the other states that do have a tipped minimum wage. And that was kind of like very consistent. That was even for small businesses with 0 to 19 employees, with 20 to 49 employees. You would think those would be the ones that were kind of struggling the most to make up those extra wages, but they did just fine. They were still growing just as well in those one fair wage states. There's also been a lot of research to show that wages just in general, like if including tips, are higher in those states. I didn't look at specifically how much take home pay people were getting, but other organizations have looked at that, and they found that median wages, one study found that median wages are about $11.44, I think it was, in one fair wage states, whereas in the states with just $2.13, the federal minimum, it's about $9 and change. So it's a pretty significant difference. Just in general, poverty rates, which is what I looked at, poverty rates are lower for tipped workers, but also for non-tipped workers. So everyone is doing better in these one fair wage states than elsewhere. When I looked at...
How do you account for that? I'm sorry, would be just because poverty, like a rising tide lifts all boats, basically. Say you're in a family with a non-tipped worker, or there's more money being put back into the economy. Is that kind of what you would
expect? So when I say non-tipped workers, I'm saying specifically non-tipped workers in these tipped industries. That's what I looked at specifically.
Sorry.
So
yes.
Just in general, the industries are doing well. People in those industries are doing well. They're not losing jobs to make up for the extra money paid. And just to say something that a lot of people actually don't know is all businesses are required to pay to make up any difference that if a person doesn't bring home enough in tips to make the regular minimum wage, businesses are required to give them what's called a tip credit. So basically, if minimum wage is $10, after tips, I only bring in $8 an hour, you're supposed to give me that extra $2 an hour as a business owner. But wage theft is rampant, particularly in like the restaurant industry, because the onus is on the server, the employee, to go to their manager, who might be hostile to them, and say, you actually owe me more money than I got. And so there was a study in the early 2010s that the government looked at about 9,000 restaurants and found that over 1,000 had tip credit violations. And then 5 in 6 had some sort of other wage violation.
Yeah, that is the least shocking thing in the world, that when you put the employer's wages in the hand of the worker, that the employee's wages in the hand of the worker, the worker's own wages, I should say, it's been a long day, that the employer is going to cheat them out of it. You can't do that. And so really, it's just a redistributive thing, or it's an administrative difference, right? Because even if these restaurants or whatever, the employers are just paying higher wages, they would technically be doing the same thing if they were actually abiding by the makeup rule that you just discussed. So it's really a way of enforcing that makeup rule in a sense. Would you agree?
Yes, but it's also the when we have a tipped minimum that is lower than the regular minimum wage, it's a way for employers to pawn off their wages, their responsibility to pay their employees the minimum wage, what should be a living wage, but that's a whole other conversation. But it takes their responsibility off of them and puts it onto the customers. And so when we make the tipped minimum wage the same as the regular minimum wage, we are putting that responsibility to pay that base wage that is supposed to be a living wage, but is at least the minimum wage, back onto their employers. And then you can actually make tips a reward for good work. It's because at the moment, they're not a reward for good work. They're just trying to get back to even.
Right. It's exactly. You can make it a bonus as opposed to a survival kit.
Yeah. What we've seen, there was one report. It was, I believe it was done by a credit card company that looked at kind of their, what people were tipping in each state. And I summarized them, and basically it's no different in the different state groups. It varies a lot. It varies a bit state to state. Like there were some as low as like 14, 15%, some closer to 20%. But on average, when you look at the $2.13 states and the one fair wage states, they're both about 16%. And the same number of people are tipping. So it doesn't, there's a lot of worry that by, rightfully so, I think, to be worried by servers in the industries that they're going to get lower tips, but that actually doesn't end up happening.
Can you talk about how in your figures you found that women saw the biggest reduction in poverty rates? Like, I think we hear so much lip service from politicians about how they want to help women or help people of color in terms of, you know, bootstraps or whatever you hear from center right to centrist. This seems like a very tangible way to actually help women and people of color, just based on the data that you've laid out.
Yeah, I mean, the easiest way to help people who are earning less is to raise their wages and to create more low-wage jobs and to not make them so low-wage. So a lot of these jobs are pretty low-wage, which I think we've gotten into a lot. And women work 68%. Women are 68% of the tipped workforce. So when you raise the wages of the tipped workforce, women are going to benefit a bit more. And that's not even, men are not suffering in exchange for women doing better. It's men's poverty rates dropped about 1%, and then women's poverty rates dropped about 6%. So it's kind of what I showed was the gap between them got smaller. And so it went from, I think, about
16%. We can't have that.
So it went from about 16% poverty for tipped female workers to and 10% poverty for tipped male workers to 9% and 11% or something like that. So it's just shrinking the gap, but everyone is doing better.
Right. That sounds.
And I didn't have large enough sample sizes to look into that for different races, but just by the same logic, basically every person of color is working is more likely to be working in a tipped industry than a white person. It was about 48% people of color in tipped industries versus 37% for the regular labor force. So they will also be benefiting more than white people, even though white people are also just having lower poverty rates because it's lower poverty rates all around.
Yeah, you can extrapolate, obviously. Yeah. So lastly, and I'll let you go, I know that you are focused on the data a lot, and this research is really compelling. Everyone can read it at the Center for American Progress. But just really throughout your research, can you touch on how these elements of white supremacy that originated in the tipped wage just still linger even today, just based on the data that you're looking at, but also how important that is in terms of understanding the broader context behind everything we're talking about here?
Yeah, I mean, it just goes back to kind of the creation of this type of job where you are reliant on tips for your livelihood, as opposed to just on top of whatever you were already earning. They were created as a form to oppress newly freed Black people and keep them that there was a quote in that I quoted in the report that like servile to their white patrons or something along those lines. It's throughout the history. It's the reason they weren't included in the original minimum wage because the Southern senators who were kind of holding it up and who were the deciding votes in the New Deal for a lot of stuff said, we will not include these things. Certainly it tips workers from lashing back out and from denying service to customers for racist behavior. It's all throughout there. And that's not to say that like any restaurant owner who is using tips minimum is like independently racist. It's more about the whole system. It was created in a racist way and is being used to further those aims. And it would just be good to get rid of that.
For sure. 100%. Justin Schweitzer, he is the policy analyst at the Poverty to Prosperity Program for the Center for American Progress. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Well, that's it for another week of Ring of Fire. Are you still subscribed to the free show? Well, head over to rofpodcast.com. Support the show by becoming a member. And today, when you do, you will hear some bonus content. An interview I did with Professor Lawrence Lessig, Harvard Law professor, on HR1. Meantime, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. Go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And check out my daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm for my daily live stream or later as a podcast. We cover all the biggest news stories of the day, and we do in-depth interviews. That's with me and Emma Vigeland. So check it out. And for Emma Vigeland and Heather Parton, I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire Radio. I got a bad disease. Off from my brain is where I bleed. Insanity, it seems.